Into the Fold is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world. Brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin, the opinions expressed in this podcast represent the views of the hosts and guests and not of the University of Texas at Austin.
Racial slavery and the system of antebellum slavery super exploited Black bodies and denigrated their mental health and well-being, their physical health and well-being, and traumatized them, right? But at the same time, we could say that Black resistance, the whole Black survival, Black lives mattering and wanting to thrive, basically in terms of cultivating Black love against all odds, that helped us survive and helped at times mitigate these aspects of trauma.
Hi, welcome to Into the Fold, the mental health podcast. I am your host, Ike Evans, and today we're delighted to bring you episode 120, Why History? At the time of this recording, the University of Texas at Austin is set to begin the fall semester of 2021. It will be the first semester since the pandemic began in which the majority of students and staff will be expected to be on campus. To say that the world looks different now compared to March of 2020 is a vast understatement. We're not the same. Our lives are different. Our politics is different. Our base understandings of what we can count on from each other, of what we can hold ourselves and others accountable for and to whom, are different. I haven't spent much time on campus since the pandemic started, but I know it's different. I don't routinely talk to UT students nowadays, but I know they're different. Even our one true mainstay as a campus community, the one thing that could always seemingly bind us together, UT Athletics, is different. History is both an example of what is different and is playing a central role in it. Controversies over statues, school names, curriculum, are adding to people's frayed nerves and further contributing to this sense of lost equilibrium. To my mind, I have always seen history as fundamental to people's ways of sense-making, which in turn has ramifications for their well-being. Our guest for this episode, historian Dr. Peniel Joseph of the University of Texas at Austin, will be joining us for a look at how his own life and career lends credence to that idea. But before we get to that, you should know that in previous episodes, we focused on history as one of the key social determinants of health, one that is of particular importance for historically excluded groups. In episode 65, we brought on Dr. Ryan Sutton, co-author of The Past Does Matter, a nursing perspective on post-traumatic slave syndrome, which was published in the Journal of Racial and Ethnic Health Disparities. Dr. Sutton and his co-author argue that slavery was a major stress event for Black people in the United States, with transgenerational effects that persist to the present. Here's a sample of that conversation.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between dwelling and ruminating on the past and intentionally thinking about or reflecting on your past in order to do two things. One, place context to your situation, and two, reclaim your narrative. Right. There's times where as a society in this country, we have chose to ignore issues of race and just, quote unquote, move on. It doesn't solve anything. There's a lot of things that fester up beneath, and it impacts continual institutional racism and other ways that we see different groups be oppressed even in today's society. So there has to be some bit of addressing the issue. You know, we often hear things like, well, that happened over 100 years ago. Let it go. Or that was way in the 60s. Why are we still talking about that? You know, we'll even say things like that even happened last year. Why are we still talking about that? But processing is important, and there's no timeline on how long the processing process should take. So to have a historical perspective impacts, you know, how conscious we are concerning ourselves, concerning our environment, concerning others, and is really related to emotional IQ. Do I understand what's going on with me? Do I understand my own feelings, thoughts, and perceptions, and then be able to understand that of somebody else in order to make our dynamic that much more healing, that much more transformative, that much more relational. And if we don't have these historical perspectives or we're not thinking about these things, then we're just kind of ignoring them. And that's really not doing much for relationship among us.
That clip was from episode 65, The Past Does Matter, a look at post-traumatic slave syndrome. You can find a link to it in the show description for this episode on whatever podcast app you're using, and I hope that you check it out. Returning to our focus for today, our guest, Dr. Peniel Joseph, holds a joint professorship appointment at the LBJ School of Public Affairs and the History Department in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. He is also the founding director of the LBJ School's Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. In addition to being a frequent commentator on issues of race, democracy, and civil rights, Dr. Joseph's most recent book is The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. He also wrote the award-winning books Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, A Narrative History of Black Power in America, and Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. His book, Stokely, A Life, has been called the definitive biography of Stokely Carmichael, the man who popularized the phrase Black Power. Dr. Joseph, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So tell our listeners about you. What's your background and what can you say about the scope and focus of your work?
I mean, that's a great question. Background-wise, personal life, I'm a proud native New Yorker. I'm the son of Haitian immigrants who came to the United States in 1965. I grew up in Brooklyn and Queens, New York. My mother is a retired hospital worker who worked for Mount Sinai Hospital and 1199 SEIU Union. And I was on my first picket line in elementary school. So I'm coming to scholarship by way of social justice activism and by way of having a mother who was just unusually interested in social justice, political awareness, intellectually curious, and provided a context for me to go in that direction, which otherwise, who knows what direction I would have taken. And so growing up in New York during the 1980s, drug war, racism, segregation, was very much aware that the civil rights movement had not was not finished, was incomplete. And really got a great education from activists and organizers about people like Ella Baker and Fannie Lou Hamer and Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., and the responsibilities that I had and that my generation had to continue that struggle. And all that is a preface of saying, so by the time I went to college and graduate school, all of that was instilled in me. So I didn't have an epiphany, aha moment that I was Black, or an aha moment that there's a history of racism and segregation and slavery in the United States. That was all baked in very, very early. You know, so I think you can teach kids the history of the United States at a very, very early age, really from the time that they can read. And I learned to read by the time I was in kindergarten, you know? So, yeah.
Okay, and so I just can't help but be curious. You say that there was no one aha moment, but maybe there might have been some experiences that sort of tilted the balance toward history in particular as an academic focus.
Yeah, you know, I think that's my mom's story. She always told us about me and my older brother is a physician, an ER doctor, my older brother, Kareth. My mom always told us histories about the Haitian Revolution. She told us histories about Black women and Black women's activism and Black feminism. That's one of the reasons why by the time I went to Temple University, I studied with Sonia Sanchez, the very renowned, iconic poet. And Black feminism was one of my fields of study 28 years ago, because, you know, I had a mother who was showing me sort of the really not just the importance, but the centrality of that activism to wider diasporic Black political traditions that stretch from, you know, Haiti to Harlem, from, you know, Angola to Alabama, New Orleans to Nigeria. So my mom speaks four languages, you know, she speaks Spanish and French and Haitian and English fluently, all of them. She can read and write in four languages, which I think is remarkable. So yeah, I think history for me was always about, you know, stories and narratives that impacted people's lives, whether they knew how that story was impacting the job they worked or the prison they were in or the schools their kids went to or did not go to. And so I think my mother made that very clear, and that made me very curious about history and sort of the power of history. And so by the time I entered college, you know, at 17, you know, I just never stopped and you know, graduated in 3 years and a double history and Black studies major, and then went to get a PhD in American history. And I knew I was going to, you know, study Black folks, and I was interested in Black people.
My organization, the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health, you know, we don't just see mental health as an individual concern. You know, we recognize the systemic and structural nature of barriers to mental health and how those, you know, how those systemic barriers impact, you know, different communities differently. So this is a big question, and take all the time that you need. Can you think of examples from your own training as a historian that really helped to illustrate the connection between past conditions and present day well-being?
Oh yeah, absolutely, numerous. I think the history of racial slavery, which I studied in grad school and continue to study, histories of Reconstruction, histories of Black struggles for citizenship and dignity, really are wellness and mental health issues as well. You know, some of it is in a very practical policy way, where you think about racial slavery and the system of antebellum slavery, super exploited Black bodies and denigrated their mental health and well-being, their physical health and well-being, and traumatized them, right? But at the same time, we could say that Black resistance, the whole Black survival, Black lives mattering and wanting to thrive, found and created Black joy in African food folkways, in oral traditions, in storytelling, basically in terms of cultivating Black love against all odds, that helped us survive and helped at times mitigate these aspects of trauma and these aspects of violence against our physical and mental well-being. So I would say that really from the inception, you know, when you think about 20 and odd Africans in 1619 in Jamestown, which is British North America, 1776, and the status of Black people as, you know, this species of property, that continues into the Reconstruction period, the Jim Crow period, racial segregation and redlining, the whole notion of food justice and environmental racism, or even food injustice and food deserts, and really the Tuskegee syphilis experiment and what's happened to Black people historically when it comes to experimentation, the theft of Black cadavers by the medical industry going back to the 19th century. It all impacts us today. And I think the largest way our mental health is impacted is really the wealth disparity and the disparity in power relations between Black people and the rest of the country, primarily white people, but really the whole entire country, because it is that wealth inequality that leads to the destruction of Black citizenship and dignity, because wealth allows people to amplify their political power, you know, have their communities thrive. And this is more than just income. This is wealth. This is land. This is assets that have been systematically plundered from the Black community, from both historically and contemporaneously, I might add.
So the Hawk Foundation is a part of the University of Texas, very proudly, and we can, you know, we're very much a part of the, you know, the greater UT community. So even under normal circumstances, we, you know, we'd have reason to be concerned about the climate on campus. But I think it's safe to say that, you know, that we're all under stress and strain right now. Mm-hmm. And so one thing I ask this of most professors that I talk to nowadays, but what have you noticed about the mood of UT students in general, students of color in particular, just over these last few semesters, and how is it different than if you had been asked this, like, say, 10 years ago?
Yeah, that's a great question, Imani. I think that the difference between now and 10 years ago is the fact that issues of systemic racism and structural racism and white supremacy receive much more acknowledgement and have really become central to Black students' own personal, not just political narratives. So that awareness, which we saw reach a peak in 2020, but again, we saw an awareness when Barack Obama became president. We saw an awareness with Hurricane Katrina. We saw an awareness with Black Lives Matter in 2013, with the publication of the new Jim Crow, Bryan Stevenson, Alicia Garza, Stacey Abrams, and then the election of Donald Trump. So there are many instances, but I'd say that now there's a clearer understanding. And this goes back to what we were saying earlier about history. So what history helps you do is have a narrative of your own life and the relationship between yourself and the larger world, your country, your state, your city. And I think now, because of the Black Lives Matter movement and the George Floyd protests after the murder of George Floyd, murders of Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Sandra Bland, so many different Black folks who have been killed by the police and by law enforcement and by structural violence. And that's gotten so much attention, and the way in which that violence and death and exploitation impacts Black student wellness and their mental health, and the way in which they've been called on without pay or remuneration to become race experts and to sort of be diversity experts, things that had always occurred before, but really got more amplified. And they know in their own lives, they might be suffering from a lack of financial and emotional and spiritual resources for their own well-being. I think that that has been much more, the awareness has been magnified infinitely. And so many Black students have said, hey, they're not going to take it anymore. In the same fashion that Nicole Hannah-Jones, who is the brilliant Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and editor of the 1619 Project, refused tenure at University of North Carolina to go to Howard University, and saying, look, it's not her job to try to transform a place like the University of North Carolina and make it some anti-racist place, make it some safe place. Like, and Black people are called to do that in a lot of ways. So I think at the University of Texas, where we have our own, you know, unbelievably troubled past when it comes to racism, institutional, structural, and otherwise, and we have a continued structural racism and inequality presently. We can see it with just the low numbers of Black students, faculty, staff, people on the board of regents, people who are connected to the supply chains of power and privilege that center around University of Texas. The only place where we're going to be overrepresented is just Black athletes playing basketball and football here, but not necessarily even then getting access to the supply chains of wealth that athleticism actually creates and builds, and the money and the resources for people. So I'd say that they're very much more aware of their own story and how that fits. And now the challenge for them is, like, you know, what are they going to do about it?
So from your own position as a member of the campus community, you know, what do you feel that you can most do to support, or things that you're, you know, what in fact are you already doing to, you know, to try to help to support or improve the campus climate for students of color?
Oh yeah. So, you know, I run at the LBJ School. One, I'm proud to and really honored to be the Barbara Jordan Chair in Ethics and Political Values at the LBJ School. And I'm the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy, and a professor of history and liberal arts. So you know, what I've done, and this is my seventh year at UT, is really through not just my classes, but through the center, we have fellows, student fellows who do research for a year and mentor those student fellows, provide them with resources, provide them with a safe space to talk about all these, to critically think about these issues. I've done, you know, hundreds of just talks and lectures around campus in the time that I've been here and the city and nationally as well. So I've done everything in my power to be a resource. And really, I think of leadership in the same way that Martin Luther King Jr., one of the people I write about, thought of leadership as something that you could be of. The best example is service-oriented leadership, right? Or servant-oriented leadership. So I always think about how I can be of help, how I can use this historical knowledge to inspire, you know, and create a context so students can really feel like they're heard and their voice and their intellect, their aspirations matter, right? So I'd say in a number of different ways, you know, it's the courses I teach, it's the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy, it's trying to raise money where we can give that money to students, and we've placed students with summer internships in some of the leading sort of for-profit sector companies here that pay them, and trying to connect Silicon Valley here in Austin to our Black students at University of Texas, who are often overlooked, even if they're business majors, to get the best opportunities that are out there upon graduation.
Okay, so my organization uses the word resilience a lot, in reference to our mission. And I have always had the thought, so first of all, you ought to know that I have a liberal arts background. Mm-hmm. And even sometimes to my detriment, I'm able to kind of see the connections between like different discourses. And I've always thought that the ability to think historically is a key part of resilience, at least at the community level. So if you grant my premise, how concerned are you that the teaching of history has become as politicized as it seems to have been?
Oh, no, I'm very concerned. I think the assaults on teaching about the history of white supremacy in this country, the history of racial slavery, the history of both the denial of Black citizenship and dignity, but also the struggle for and how Black people have changed this nation in terms of through music, the Black church, our intellect, our dance, our aesthetic, our democratic aspirations, is catastrophic. But it's as a historian, it's also unsurprising. It's also unsurprising. You know, there's a great new book called Wilmington's Lie about white supremacy in the 1898 white riot that murdered Black people and made sure that the Democratic Party in Wilmington, the all-white Democratic Party, would take control of the city of Wilmington. And it goes into great detail about the violence, the massing of guns, the smearing of Black people as rapists and as animals, and the way in which the federal government and state government and other institutions did nothing to stop this. And you ended up with large amounts of bloodshed, Black people fleeing when all they had done the previous 33 years in Wilmington from the end of the Civil War to 1898 was try to struggle for citizenship and dignity. Black men voted when they could and agitated for their civil and human rights. And so to not be able to teach that and to call that critical race theory or to call that anti-American, it really is in keeping with this whole history of the lost cause. And the lost cause is the lie that says that the Confederacy was good, that they weren't traitors who deserved to be thrown in jail. It's the lie that says Robert E. Lee was a hero. It's the lie that so much of American democracy is premised on. So one of the interesting junctures of 2020 is that what you saw in 2020 were people who were resisting that lie and 15 to 26 million came out in the streets saying that this was a lie. But we have such a long history of at least half of the country in other historical contexts more believing and worshiping at the altar of that white supremacist lie. It's not surprising that in states like this that are very, very anti-democratic, that are extraordinarily racist, unapologetically so, that you're going to have a movement that says you can't teach that history. Because if you teach the truth about American history, you have a chance to change and transform that redundant cycle of anti-Black racism and anti-Black violence and anti-Blackness that we are all ensconced in, right? And so I'm not surprised about that, but I also think that Black people are the most resilient people on the planet. And I think that even with these new obstacles that are in people's ways to try to teach this history, the genie has been let out of the bottle, and this history is still going to be taught and learned and imbibed and debated, critically examined by new generations of young people, of students, of Americans, and people around the world.
My last question is a little bit more personal. Does your own prominence and visibility as a Black historian ever cause you stress or feel burdensome? And how have you managed to cope with it?
You know, I think this idea of stress and you know, being emotionally vulnerable and trying to come to terms with being, you know, a Black person, a Black American, Black Haitian, is really important, because I think a lot of times we refuse to talk about the emotional impact and assaults that white supremacy inflict on us. So I would say that, you know, by nature, I'm an optimistic person. So I'm a person who sees things as the glass half full, and sees opportunities even when or amidst challenges and conflicts. So I'd say that I think I tend to be very, very optimistic, but I can get depressed as well, and I can get sadness or ennui about the state of the world, and certainly the state of Black America. So I would say the things that help me cope, one, history has always helped me cope. So Black history, Black culture, Black music, Black film, I'm interested in all of it. So I'm not somebody who divides our cultural production into some high, low barometers. I'm interested in all of it. I love Black folks who do hip hop, who do jazz, the blues, ragtime. I love Haitian and world music. All of that helps me, you know. I'm a Black Christian, and I also have a spiritual practice. I grew up at New Bethel Baptist Church in New York City. So a Southern Black Baptist church by way of a New York City storefront, which can only happen in New York City because of the diaspora that we sometimes call Great Migration. And that's why I grew up knowing about Juneteenth, because we had Black folks from Texas and New York who told us about Juneteenth. So people would say, well, how'd you know? Well, we had Black folks from Texas who told us about it and celebrated it and taught us it, right? So when I think about like what helps me cope, you know, I've got a spiritual practice. I do yoga. My daughter, my partner. So there's so many different aspects of my life that is emotionally rich and resonant in spite of the challenges. And I also feel greatly blessed and that I have great opportunities to be able to read this history, to teach it full time, to write about it and to struggle with it. You know, I mean, I've been doing this now for, you know, over, you know, 25 years. And the interesting thing is the deeper you get into it, the less you realize you know. You know, and that gives you, you know, more humility too, right? And so by the time you're facing your students, your students might think, wow, this is this hill. How am I going to climb this hill? But you're really on the same journey with them. You just might be a little further. You might be a little further ahead, but you're really on the same journey with them. So, I do think that this impacts all of us, and sometimes, especially those of us who are in a space of trying to make sense of it and seeing all these Black people get killed, Black anti-Black racism, marginalization can sometimes make us not stop to celebrate the joy. You know, I think about the documentary Summer of Soul, right? With Questlove, which is a great documentary about the 1969 Harlem Fest, right? There's so much we should also be celebrating. And I think that's why in 2018, Black Panther became, one of the biggest hits films in history, because people saw just a positive, complex reflection of a diasporic Blackness up on screen. And they just went to see it with their kids, their families, whole churches and schools went to see it 2 and 3 and 4 times. You know, people couldn't believe it. They sold out of the toys. They sold out of all the paraphernalia. Why? It's because, that is food and nourishment for the soul that too often we don't get as Black people. So I'd say that, I definitely feel privileged to be able to teach this and to be able to study this and to be able to learn from this and learn alongside of students. And these students are brilliant. Our Black students here at the University of Texas are brilliant, very, very optimistic, very, very focused. And so it's really been a privilege and a pleasure to learn alongside of them. But yes, I think it is tough and difficult. And at times there are bad days or bad hours in the day. But I always try to remember what's most important for me in my life. And that's family, that's my faith, that's my friends. And that keeps me steadfast.
The theme is trauma and resilience through the eyes of a historian, not the kind of conversation that the Hogg Foundation is most known for, but one that I still think is vitally important and very much appreciated. So on behalf of our listeners, we really do appreciate you taking the time, Dr. Joseph.
Thank you.
This is not the first time that we have had a look at goings-on on campus. Back in 2018, we sat down with Dr. Leonard Moore, then the new vice president of the Division of Diversity and Community Engagement at UT, of which the Hogg Foundation is a part. He has since moved out of that position, but his words still carry a great deal of resonance today. Here's a listen.
I think our approach may be a little different, Ike. I tell students all the time, there are times when bias incidents pop up on campus. And as a daytime community, UT has about 70,000 people on campus every single day. We're a miniature city. So no matter what we do, as a university, you can't prevent somebody from going and put up a flyer that says discriminatory thing, right? You just can't. But what I tell students that, you can hold the university responsible for how we respond to it, As it relates to campus culture, I think, I was just engaged with some conversation with people over in Greek Life. They're starting to do more diversity issues. And this is West Campus. These some of our, fraternities and sororities,
right,
who have traditionally been, pretty white. But even they are beginning to think about issues of diversity. I had a meeting with a director of the Longhorn Band, and he wants to know how to make his organization more diverse. So I think when we start getting, African Americans and Latinos and other people into spaces they haven't been before, I think it creates a healthy campus climate. But also I'll say this, we also have to teach our students how to be resilient, letting them know that people will say things you don't like, and people may shout things you don't like, and people may express opinions you don't agree with, but our goal is to help them understand that that's life, whether we like it or not, and, that they can overcome it and be resilient and keep moving forward in spite of it.
That was from episode 73, Keeping the Flagship of Diversity on Course. I've included a link in the show description. yet more rich conversation about the mission of the University of Texas and how diversity and inclusion is central to that mission, what executing that mission looks like. So please check it out. Have a listen. And that does it for this episode. We're glad that you could join us. If you have comments or anything that you would like to share about the podcast, feel free to reach out to us at intothefold@austin.utexas.edu. Especially thoughtful comments will be acknowledged during a future episode. Production assistance by Veronica Rodriguez and Anna Harris. And much thanks to the Hogg Foundation for always supporting us. Just as taking care of ourselves enhances our ability to help others, so it is as well that by helping others, we enhance our own resilience. Please leave us a review, subscribe to us on the podcast app of your choice. We are on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and TuneIn. Thanks for joining us.